This episode is brought to you by Cabot Creamery, proud to be a dairy farm family-owned cooperative for more than 100 years. Learn more at cabotcheese.coop. That's cabotcheese.coop.
This week on Meat and Three, we're looking at things that have changed and things that are still in flux. From mothers balancing new lifestyles to the social stigma surrounding pumpkin spice.
You got rid of the star rating system and talked about, like, I'm not going to use the word ethnic when I talk about food.
They recognized that safety was our motivation, and they were very, you know, receptive to the changes, understanding what we were trying to accomplish.
A cupcake or a piece of bacon or a glass of rosé is not inherently gendered.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So my guest here is Kevin Mitchell. Kevin and I go way back, probably about 10, 15 years. And Kevin's bio is pretty extensive. He's an instructor, first of all, which I give him a lot of credit for. Teaching people how to cook is the most difficult thing in the world to do. He's also on the National Board of Slow Food, member of the Southern Foodways Alliance. He's an ambassador for Charleston and South Carolina, food ambassador and a member of the Culinary Institute of America Diversity Board. He's also, like I said before, a great friend of mine, and I'm really proud to have him as one of the first guests of Soul by Todd Richards. So welcome, Kevin Mitchell, my good friend and pal.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. So let's think about this. Was it at in Jacksonville? We first met with Joe Rando, Erica, Dwayne was there.
Yeah. Well, we met before. I think we met at the inaugural Atlanta Wine and Food Festival,
right,
at the opening party, dinner, whatever that was. That's where we met face to face, but we had been, you know, through social media, of course, following and kind of talking. But I think that was when we first met face to face.
I remember you had a Berber spice that you still won't give me the damn recipe for it, you know?
I'll send it to you.
I've been trying to get it.
I was just using that the other night, actually, in here cooking, so.
I remember that. And you did a seafood dish, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was, we did scallops. Scallops and... Yeah. A salad of black-eyed peas and mango. It had a little cumin, some orange, and other things like that in it. And then did that toasted pistachio and orange peel garnish with that. Yeah.
With you being in Charleston, I really wanted to, and you know, I'm in Atlanta, and though we're in the South, we're still worlds apart. What's happening in Charleston? What's happening with black restaurant scene or black chefs in Charleston right now?
I won't say non-existent, but we do have a few, of the old standbys, you know, the Gullah restaurants that are here, you know, Bertha's Kitchen, Martha Lou's, Hannibal's, so on and so forth. Those are still holding on through, of course, the pandemic. But, you know, you know this here in Charleston as far as other restaurants. There's a huge lack of black representation of executive chefs running some of the better restaurants in the city. And that's been somewhat of a problem here. I mean, I've been living here for 12 years, so it's still kind of ongoing through the pandemic, through, of course, the death of George Floyd. A lot of the restaurants here, a lot of the black chefs or black caterers are starting to get a little bit of traction. But like with anything, it's still not enough. I mean, we're still very invisible in the culinary landscape, specifically here in Charleston.
Do you think that is because of finance? Is it because of insular system in Charleston? Do you think it's because of lack of appreciation for Gullah cuisine or lack of knowledge? I know BJ, of course, is BJ Dennis, the greatest ambassador of it. But then we also see that, you know, chefs have made rice culture popular, which is basically out of Charleston as well. So what is the factors that contribute to this lack of visibility, lack of restaurant ownership, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of different things. I mean, we've always talked about the lack of capital. That's always one of the most important things here. You know, rents here in Charleston and on some of the better streets where the restaurants are astronomical. And I just think, and this is for me throughout the country, it's just, you know, a lack of people really knowing where the black chefs are, not necessarily wanting to invest in a black chef to either own a restaurant or even, you know, be an executive chef and run a kitchen. So I think it goes, you know, many, many different ways. We can have, you know, longer conversations about any of those reasons as to why. And, you know, we've speak to other people in the industry, of course, you know, our white counterparts, and some of them have been very candid and say, you know, it's capital. It's a lack of, you know, that proverbial question, where are the black chefs? And we know where we are, but is it a thing of, are they actually looking for us? And that is a major problem as well.
You know, you know, we've had this conversation, you know, mm-hmm. both in public and in private about where we are. And we see in the last 2 years or 3 years, you have Mashamba Bailey, mm-hmm. Eduardo Jordan, Nina Compton of the world win, you know, Beard Awards. And we see progress in that aspect of it. But we don't necessarily see progress in restaurant ownership. And to your point, it does come down to finance. But still, you know, what is the future of Charleston's dining scene without more black chef or black restaurateur involvement?
Well, one thing I see, you know, which is a very sad thing. I mean, in Charleston, you know, we have there's a lot of gentrification going on. And a lot of those restaurants that I mentioned earlier, you know, of course, they're smaller restaurants. They're, you know, could be considered mom and pop restaurants, and those are dying off slowly. And I think, you know, we mentioned BJ. I think with BJ, you know, being that ambassador, he's opening the eyes of people to, you know, really give some respect to those specific restaurants. But you know, it definitely goes back to, you know, gentrification, neighborhood, people moving into specific neighborhoods, or, you know, we have places downtown where, you know, the only grocery store in the area is closed down. And now those people that live in that area have to find another place to purchase food, and almost turning into, you know, a food desert. But I think the nature of the restaurant business as a whole, you know, it's hard to say. You know, the pandemic has definitely affected a lot of the restaurants here in Charleston. They, you know, of course, have been closed for many months. They reopen. One of the staff members, you know, catches, you know, COVID, and then next thing you know, they have to shut down the restaurant again. So a lot of that stuff is just really up in the air. And, you know, my hope is, you know, of course, through my work being a chef instructor and inspiring young African American students to go out there and do their thing and open up their own places. And, you know, we definitely talk about capital, but, you know, we can overcome that. We can you know, fund our own projects and do many great things.
As a culinary instructor, I mean, you see minds at the young age of learning how to cook. And we both know that cooking is something that you continuously learn, but you can, you know, people straight out of high school, some even older, some out of the military coming back. What is the great part about being an instructor for you?
Well, one definitely is seeing one of my former students go on and, you know, do great things, start their own businesses, you know, run kitchens throughout not only Charleston, but throughout the country. You know, and I have a lot of really great success stories of students who have gone on and done some really great things. And that is one of the most important things for me to see and to be involved in as an instructor. But more short term in the classroom is just seeing that student when they finally, you know, when that light bulb finally clicks on and they really are starting to understand what this business is about. I mean, you mentioned I do get a combination of different students from different backgrounds, different ages, coming from other, you know, other careers. And the younger generation, it's, you know, they're of course media driven, and they watch Top Chef and they watch Hell's Kitchen and they watch all these shows, which are great. But when you don't really understand that most of that is all about the entertainment factor in the program, you know, it's hard to kind of get those younger students to really come back down to earth and not, you know, have this, and not that it's a bad dream for them to have to be the next Top Chef or to be the next Iron Chef, but to also, you know, let them understand that, you know, it takes a lot more than, you know, being able to cook to have a TV show on the Food Network or even to be a contestant on these shows. I mean, it's, you know, it's just more than that. And, you know, some of the greater students that I have are those who are older. They may be career changers. We definitely, you know, our school definitely is extremely military friendly. So we do get a lot of students who come from the military, and they come in and, you know, through their military background, they are, I guess, more equipped to really understand the regimen of being in school. And then, of course, just to understand the regimen of just being a chef and showing up on time and being in proper uniform and, you know, and being prepared for class and having your recipes and reading the recipes and having your mise en place. So I mean, it's just a lot of different things, but those success stories are always great for me to see, you know, when a student comes back and says, "Chef, you know, I'm the executive chef here," or I just had, I mean, you remember, Davin,
right? Davin. Yeah. Great
Davin. Kid. Yeah. He and his wife just started a catering business not too long ago. And you know, she actually went and got her culinary and pastry degree as well. So, and they're doing, you know, they're, you know, things, I'm sure, slow through the pandemic, but they jumped out there and started their own business. And that is a great thing. He was, you know, you've worked with him. He's a great, great, great guy, definitely talented and really understands, you know, what it takes to be in this business.
You know, the reason why I asked you that question is because a lot of times the stereotypes of things, you know, they say, well, you know, chefs that can't really cook are instructors.
They teach.
Yeah. Right, they teach, you know, which is the biggest fallacy in the world to me, because we all are teachers as chefs. We are teachers, parents, social workers, instructors, tax accountants, you know, all those things. And to just say that just because you're an instructor, you get dismissed out of the culinary field of being or a culinary expert, to me is absolutely laughable. I want to take a quick break right quick, Kev.
Okay.
We got to have our sponsors really speak for us right now because they pay the bills, and we'll be right back in a couple of seconds. All right?
All right. All right.
Cabot Creamery has been making the world's finest dairy products for over 100 years. Cabot's award-winning cheddars and other dairy products stand apart because of their farmers' tireless dedication to quality and freshness, caring for their animals, and to healthy land and a sustainable future. More than a century after they started this journey, Cabot's farmer owners still know what matters most. Family and community, the simple truth that we're stronger together than we are apart. That delicious products are the reward of a job well done. That when you love what you do this much, that the best is always still to come.
Okay, so we're back with my great friend, Chef Kevin Mitchell in Charleston. And Kevin, I want to pivot a little bit because I know that you have been working on a book. You know that you're a culinary ambassador for South Carolina. Let's talk about that culinary ambassador for South Carolina. I mean, to me, it's really a great thing to represent a state, something like South Carolina, but also a place that is steeped in history, both positive and negative, especially when you consider all the slave ports that were on that coast. Tell me about, you know, who asked you to be an ambassador of South Carolina, and really, what is the crux of what you're showcasing to the world?
Yeah, well, the Chef Ambassador Program is a program that is built with the state of South Carolina. Companies or, you know, organizations like Discover South Carolina, they do work with the governor's office, and it's a appointed position. So throughout the year, you know, chefs from what they do is they split up the state into four sections, and each section of the state has a person that they are, you know, they are the ambassador to, and it, of course, it makes there's four of us. So through the nominations throughout, the governor and some of the other, you know, Department of Agriculture here, they get together, they go through the nominations, and then they actually choose which chef from what part of the state is going to represent as a chef ambassador. And you are actually appointed by the governor. You go to the governor's mansion in Columbia, and there's a big press conference, and it's a complete, total, like, formal introduction. And what we are supposed to do is basically preach the gospel of South Carolina food, definitely South Carolina ingredients, because it is, you know, a partnership with the Department of Agriculture. And what we do is we are normally, without the pandemic, we're supposed to travel and do events that and feature ingredients from South Carolina, dishes from South Carolina, and just, you know, once again, just preaching the gospel of the beauty of the food that comes from our state, and also, of course, the local produce. Now, because we can't necessarily travel, a lot of our work is done via social media. So, you know, normally we're asked to, you know, create a dish using a local product or a local ingredient produced or grown in the state, and take pictures and create a recipe, and it's, you know, it's blasted all over social media. And for me, it's a huge honor. I am the first chef instructor to become a chef ambassador in the program. I believe started back in 2014, I believe. So it's a great thing, because for me, I can use my voice as an instructor. Also, definitely use my voice as a historian and talk about the historical aspects of the food of South Carolina, just like you said, also encompassing the, you know, the enslaved or formerly enslaved people from Charleston who, you know, who basically are the foundation for, you know, what we know today as Southern food. So it's a huge honor. It's an appointment that lasts for a full year. Actually, for us, through the pandemic, because we haven't really been able to do much, They are going to probably extend it throughout the year of 2021, where hopefully we'll be able to do some more traveling. I mean, we do have a couple of events coming up soon, hopefully that won't get canceled. Euphoria in Greenville.
Right, Euphoria, yeah.
So we're kind of getting ready for that. And we're supposed to be doing a James Beard dinner sometime in October. We're still waiting on some details for that, whether or not that's going to happen. But as it stands now, Euphoria is going to happen. We have a media brunch that we're doing on the Saturday of the event, and then Sunday we're involved with the Sunday supper.
So how crazy does that feel, you know, that the rest of the country is you know, basically closed. California just closed again. Florida is in a state of open closure. You know, they're a revolving door right now, but mm-hmm. South Carolina is wide open. And events like Euphoria, a wonderful food festival is happening. But, you know, in the back of your mind, you think about COVID and those things that have to go along with it. But you still sound like you're passionate about, you know, your post as ambassador. What ingredients, I mean, do you just look for to come from South Carolina that you use in your daily cooking?
Well, we have, of course, there's a list of products that are produced here in the state. So if you're looking at, like actually the other day, a former student of mine works for Sally's Best, and they create simple syrups and jams and things like that. And it's what they call certified South Carolina. So it is a certified South Carolina product. They sent me some free samples, and what I'm going to figure out what to do with them and, you know, create a dish using some of those products. And then, of course, post on my social media, specifically, you know, the Instagram and the Facebook. But I also use a lot of the other things, the local produce, some of the other ingredients. So for me, I look at Carolina Gold rice, Sea Island red peas. I use a lot of Bene seeds and Bene seed oil in a lot of those particular dishes. And not specifically for those dishes, but just what I would normally cook at home too. So I have been, you know, I made a really nice peach cobbler cheesecake using some local peaches from a certified South Carolina grown producer. Even there's alcohol products that I will use in some of that, as long as they are certified South Carolina label company. So those are a lot. Those are just some of the things that I use. But I'm apt to use anything that's South Carolina, and specifically for any event that's put on by the Chef Ambassadors, we have to use, of course, certified South Carolina grown or produced products.
I mean, what's crazy is that Georgia is called the Peach State, but actually more peaches are grown in South Carolina than it is, you know, than in Georgia. Most people don't know that as a fact. I believe that, like most things in the South, is what you claim may not be factual, but the fact that you claimed it first makes it your own, you know?
Well, yeah, that can be said for something like Country Captain. I mean, if you're from Charleston, you're claiming that Country Captain comes from Charleston. But if you're from Savannah, you're like, no, wait a minute. We here in Savannah, we created that particular dish. So it's, you know, it's amazing, you know, just the power that food has.
Right. Absolutely. One thing you mentioned, you were saying you share stories of the slave and formerly slaved people. And I know your work with David Shields, correct? Mm-hmm. Really, you all are working on a book that you have shared some of it with me. And I can tell you from a person who's written a cookbook, but also as a nerd of books, that I can't wait for the full production to come out, because I believe what you're explaining in the book is a little bit different than most, where most people will talk about the downtrodden part of slavery and the downtrodden part of a country that has slavery as a long history. But you're talking about it in an aspect where there's some inspiration from overcoming the worst atrocity known to man through food. Can you share a little bit of what the book is going to be about with us?
Including the title, because
I'm not sure. I know you have a working title, but I'm not sure if the title is fully vetted.
Yeah. Well, and going back to the statement, you know, when you're talking about sharing sharing the stories of inspiration and things that are positive, that is kind of the main crux of my work. Like I, you know, we can talk about the atrocities and the downtrodden things of slavery until we're blue in the face. But for me, it's important to share the stories of these cooks formerly enslaved who rose to own their own businesses in the city of Charleston, pastry shops, hotels, restaurants, so on and so forth. And they were able to create this cuisine even through their condition being an enslaved person. So that part of the work is the most important for me. But as far as the book, it's called Taste the State, Signature Foods of Charleston and Their Stories. And we, Dave and I, are calling it a guide to Southern food, specifically those things that are tied to South Carolina. So if you look at it almost like a dictionary or an encyclopedia, we have entries, and there's about 82 entries, and they're all listed in alphabetical order. And we write short passages about a specific ingredient or a specific dish that has some ties to Charleston. So when you read this book, you'll see an entry on okra, Carolina gold rice, field peas, you know, purlieu, the Huguenot torte, the Lady Baltimore cake, things that have a connection to Charleston once again. And then, you know, in those entries, there's some general information, maybe some agricultural stuff, where it grows or how it grows, when it was first seen, you know, in the public eye, or when a recipe was first published in the book. And as far as the recipes, we're using a lot of old recipes that we're finding in newspapers from the 1700s and 1800s. And then to kind of counterbalance those older recipes, I am creating some more contemporary recipes, things that, you know, people can get in the kitchen today. And you know, if you want to cook, you know, I have this dish called peas and greens, where it's a take on taking peas, black-eyed peas, and I also use Sea Island reds and greens. And, you know, the tradition of eating, you know, Hop and John and collard greens on New Year's Eve, but taking those two things and putting them together in one dish, but also elevating it by adding tomato and coconut and curry and, you know, a little turmeric, so on and so forth. So just want to offer something a little bit more contemporary. And there will be photos in the book and
Which is a rarity for a cookbook, especially from a historic standpoint. You know, there's photos in the book, which is great.
Yeah, and we're actually taking photos ourselves. Like, as for, you know, because of the pandemic, you know, getting a photographer and so on and so forth. But some of the photos for some of the things that I have posted on my Instagram will be in the book, which is great because I have control over it. I made the dish. Now I'm going to put it in the book. And as we speak, we're still kind of going through. We have a good collection of photos. There's a few more we need to do, but we're pretty much ready for it to be sent to the copy editor. And the plan is to have it out sometime in spring of 2021.
I mean, I think that's a great time to release a book. Spring is, especially after this year of 2020, where this pandemic has definitely showcased the best and worst of people.
Yes.
They're having, you know, a fresh start in 2021. But there's you know, one final subject that I really want to discuss with you. And like I said, we have a long history together in food and understanding things from not only a Black perspective, but from a worldly perspective. And I just want to hear your thoughts on What is the future of Black food worldwide? And I put it in a caveat that I see where Nigeria is producing a modern version of its own cuisine. And I see in Brazil and more Afrocentric nations that there's more of a modern take on cuisines. So just like you said, you know, you have recipes in your book from 1700s, 1800s, but then you're also putting modern takes on this. And I really want to get your perspective as a historian, also a person who wants to talk about the future of food. What is the future of Afro food, Black food in general?
Well, I definitely feel that, for that food, for what we do, I mean, the future is bright. I mean, even despite, you know, the pandemic and, of course, some of the racial tension that's going on in the world today, and, you know, I think we are really starting to really put ourselves on these plates and really making people see what this food is about. More, whether it's more tradition or more on a contemporary stance as well. You know, like you said, we're embracing, you know, this new Nigerian thing. And, you know, you have chefs like Pierre Tam, who's representing, you know, Senegalese, and he's doing some modern takes and, you know, creating, you know, kind of like the quick, you know, 90-minute microwave bag of fonio, which is,
right,
you know, something that we probably would have never even thought of or even seen.
I mean, it's absolutely delicious. I mean, I have it. I made a dish with it. It is absolutely spectacular. And, you know, Pierre is
doing,
there's
other chefs out there that are doing, you know, modern takes on our old Southern classics. You know, you mentioned Eduardo is doing some good things, you know. Hopefully, you know, he can reopen June Baby to what it was. And, you know, he's embracing that. And, you know, other chefs like yourself and Dwayne Nutter and other, you know, I think our time is here. I think we need to really embrace it and jump on it. And definitely we need to continue to claim it. You know, it's, you know, we've talked about, you know, cultural appropriation of our food and of our culture. And it's time for us to take those things back and just embrace it and be joyous in who we are and what we have done. And, you know, and we've talked about, you know, as far as, you know, kind of growing up and going to culinary school and being in restaurants and everything's so Eurocentric and, you know, not wanting to embrace our, you know, our natural heritage in our food. And, you know, once we, you know, and I know even I was like that when I got out of CIA, I was like, I want to be, you know, the next Thomas Keller, and I'm going to create this 5-star food, and it's going to be, you know, somewhat, it's going to be American, but still Eurocentric, because that's, you know, what I feel I need to do. And we have to get past that. And we just have to, you know, embrace it. And, you know, someone like Eduardo Jordan, who I think is really amazing that he has chitlins on his menu.
Absolutely. And I've had them. And, you know, and it's been a long time since I had, you know, only person that really cooks really great chitlins is my sister. And she hasn't made them in years, you know. And most kids don't know what that smell is, you know? I mean, you know, most kids.
I know what that smell is. And it's like, whoa.
they just can't. Like, what is that? You know, it's not like you boil his socks over there or something. You know?
Someone like him to do that in a white tablecloth setting, like that is, you know, that's.
And I know, you know, that was going to be the last question, but it's going to follow up a little bit because you just brought up something that he, you know, Eduardo's done it in a white tablecloth setting. But how much is that not remiss from a setting in Charleston, where we prepare things in a white tablecloth setting and didn't get any credit for what we were doing, you know, considering the history of Charleston and with the plantations and everything there? Yeah. It doesn't seem like it's really that far removed from the history of our country, especially in an area like Charleston that on a white tablecloth setting that a black person was cooking the food for this for the masses of people who came in, but did not get any credit for it before, and is getting some credit for it now.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it definitely starts there with the enslaved. I mean, they were the main people that were doing all the cooking, right? And then, of course, you move into where these cookbooks were coming out, and they were written by whites, but they were getting the recipes from the enslaved, right? And we have been cooking on white tablecloths since the beginning of time, right? And I just think historically, you know, when food and being a chef and being in this profession becomes this white collar profession and where you can really make good money depending on where you are and what you're doing, of course, you know, and historically just whites rush in, and then of course we're pushed out, and the main people that were pushed out initially, of course, were women, because they were doing mostly all the cooking. And then, of course, you know, black people in general were completely cooked out and or, you know, kicked out. And I think that was one of the reasons why I wanted to be a chef. Like, you know, I 6 years old, I'm watching a television program about the Culinary Olympics, and I see, you know, men in crisp white jackets and tall white hats, and but I don't see anybody that looks like me, and they're preparing this beautiful food. I'm like, well, wait a minute. where are people in this that look like me? And I think that's where I was so laser focused on wanting to be that type of chef, the Thomas Keller and so on and so forth. And at some point, you know, I'll tell you, my moving to Charleston really changed my thinking about that, especially doing that Nat Fuller dinner and getting that research in and really understanding where it all comes from. My whole trajectory changed.
The beauty about it all, Kevin, is that, you know, that we have a long history in food. Yep. From the most celebrated, you know, grand dame of Southern cooking with Edna Lewis, to our living legend in Joe Randall, and then people like yourself, who are not only great historians of food, but also great ambassadors of food, especially through the lens of Black culture. Where can everyone find you on social media?
You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Chef Scholar. And you can also, you know, I also, people email me, they want recipes. So you can also email me at chefscholar@gmail.com.
I truly appreciate you being one of the first people on this episode of Soul by Todd Richards. So, like I said, we have a long history in food. I consider you more than just a friend. I consider you family. And I am honored that you brace these airwaves with me. And let's continue to celebrate Black food, Black culture, but let's also continue to celebrate our friendship as family.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for listening in, and I'll talk to you guys soon. Thank you very much. Soul by Todd Richards is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place.
and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of Food World's most innovative community? Subscribe to shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.